In this week's Nutrition and Life episode, I speak with nutrition researcher and educator Ellen Aragon, pioneer of evidence-based nutrition. Ellen and I spoke about the most common mistakes people make when it comes to fat loss, the dangers of taking things out of context, the anabolic window, and more. I'm excited for you to listen to my conversation with Ellen Aragon, and please, if you enjoy this show, subscribe, help us spread the message and take a screenshot, share it on your social media, or leave us a rating or review. Thank you so much. Now on to my conversation with Ellen. Hello and welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and today I have the absolute pleasure of speaking with Ellen Aragon, nutrition researcher and educator. He's the pioneer of evidence-based nutrition, helping the public and professionals gain knowledge and skills to reach their potential since 1992, and he's also the founder of the Ellen Aragon Research Review and an author of Flexible Dieting. Welcome to the show, Ellen.
Thank you so much for having me on, Lisa. It is a real pleasure to be here.
And yeah, I'm just excited for our audience to hear more about you, but of course also the work that you do. So why don't we start off with just a little bit of an introduction of how you got to where you are today, personally, professionally. I would love to hear more.
All right. So rounding up three decades from 1992 to 2002, I was mostly in personal training. And from 2002 to 2012, I was mostly in nutritional counseling. And from 2012 to 2024, I've mostly been in research and education. And so you mentioned that I was one of the pioneers of the evidence-based movement in the fitness industry. And that's true. About 15-ish years ago, a handful of colleagues and I decided that we really should start promoting the idea that, hey, there is a scientific basis for what we understand about improving the human body, and we can go beyond just appealing to gurus and things like that. And so we started the movement, and thank goodness it has flourished in the fitness world and in the coaching world, the personal training world, the dietetics and the nutritionism world. And so the last 12-ish years, I've had the privilege of having published a few dozen-ish studies, been involved with almost a few dozen studies. So the studies have mainly to do with improving body composition and improving athletic performance through just different integrations of nutrition and training. And I've been able to put that out there to the public and write a few position stands and I guess impact the state of the evidence and the practice guidelines of fitness professionals. And so here we are to the present day, just trying to make sure that movement keeps going. And so it's really cool to be able to be on here and discuss these kinds of topics.
Yeah, and I'm ever so grateful because truly, if it wasn't for people like yourself, you just make the research so much more digestible, so much more easy to understand and apply for people like myself who are more in the application rather than the research. But we want to, of course, do our things the right way and help the people the right way. And so truly, like your book, Flexible Dieting, is just a wonderful foundation for literally any nutrition coach, I think, or even just people interested in changing their physique. And what I have grown to love as well over the last few months is your research review. And that's actually one thing I want to kind of get a little bit into. One article in particular I'd like to ask you a few questions on. So that was an article I read not too long ago, and it was about how many things in the public are taken out of context. So for example, they just take a headline of a study and without really going into the methods or whatever, portray a specific message in just a newspaper or so. And this particular article was about the allegation that a high protein diet or high protein consumption in general could be linked to an increased risk of atherosclerosis. So obviously a pretty big claim. And so I would love for you to just tell us a little bit about what you wrote there and what caused you to write this article.
Yeah, there was a study done on rodents not too long ago. And the conclusion was that a certain percentage of protein in the diet, going beyond that, would be conducive to the gain in atherosclerotic plaque. And so this is kind of an alarming headline. And of course, you put cardiovascular disease in any kind of headline, and there are a lot of lay news pieces once that article got published saying, "Oh no, guys, protein's the bad guy. Look out, you have to keep it low and don't consume protein more than a certain amount per dose, and certainly don't consume protein beyond like the low 20% of total calories." And then you drill down a little deeper, not very deep actually, to drill down, and you'd see that the study is on rodents. And rodents have just profoundly different substrate utilization than humans do. And so when we look at nutrition research, we can pretty handily dismiss rodent findings because they have a really poor track record of reflecting actual human metabolism for the macronutrients specifically. And so when you look at the actual human research on higher versus lower protein intakes, the higher protein conditions almost always outperform the lower protein conditions for not just body compositional outcomes, but for clinical outcomes, including cardiometabolic outcomes. And so there is definitely a conflict between what this study in quotes found versus what the weight of the evidence is in the human research. And there's a lot of confusion in the nutrition world with respect to those types of claims. Over the decades, we've found fat to be the bad guy in the 1980s, and in the 1990s, carbs started to become the bad guy. And then the 2000s to 2010s, it's not carbs really, but sugar's the bad guy. And then from the 2010s and up, well, we start looking at specific oils as being the bad guy in certain niche scaremongering circles, like seed oils are the bad guy, all such nonsense. And finally, if finally had to come around to protein and leave it to a bunch of researchers doing animal models, rodent models, to draw this implication. So it's a wild ride out there.
Yeah, I think it's just a really good reminder to keep reading, not just twice, but maybe also the fine print of whatever article we might read and see. And I'm also looking more at people like you or Lane Norton or something who tend to like really go into the nitty-gritty of a certain study as opposed to just someone who makes a random claim without any backup. And yeah, I'm curious to hear what inspired you to write Flexible Dieting. Was that something that had been in the works for a long time, or has that come out of a specific inspiration?
I wish I had a triumphant and heroic story for you about the book Flexible Dieting, but it really was just the product of my friend Brett Contreras calling me and saying that his friends at Victory Belt Publishing wanted me to write the book on flexible dieting. So, hey, please reach out to Alan, present him with the idea. And so Brett just essentially convinced me and sold me on the idea of writing the book. And the way that he convinced me about it was he said, "Alan, you have a lot of students and followers in the space who promote your ideas, your original ideas. And here's Victory Belt. They're a major publishing company, and they want you to write the book on flexible dieting. So you really should do it. Otherwise, if you don't do it, then one of your students is going to write the book and then just parrot basically what you've been saying, and then you won't get the credit." And when he put it that way, I was like, "Oh gosh, well, maybe I better do this."
Well, I mean, that's still a pretty good reason, and I believe it probably was just a compilation of all the work that you had been doing leading up to the point, and just putting it into one concise medium, I guess. So I would highly recommend anybody, again, like I said, anybody out there to read this book or to even just have it at home as something of like, oh, I'm wondering about this and that, and then you can go back and look something up. That's what I have found quite helpful about it anyway.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that, 'cause the book is mistitled. It's just that like a clickbait title. The book is really just I wanted to call it evidence-based nutrition, but that idea got shot down because that's a boring title.
Well,
So yeah,
but
that's
I think it's still thankfully they didn't make you title it something like if it fits your macros or something like that. I think with flexible dieting, we're still on the page of whole foods and all the good things that you wrote about in there. And talking about like more specifics of in terms of diets, you also do a wonderful job on your Instagram to kind of debunk things or to touch on topics of the season of the day, flavors of the day. And one thing, for example, that I saw you speak about recently was the carnivore diet. And the question was kind of posed like, is carnivore healthy? Maybe you can speak to that.
It's healthy if you add fruits and vegetables and legumes and dairy and even grains. Grains are kind of a double-edged sword, and people don't really present it much as that. But you certainly can have you have almost a wider variety of refined grain slash problematic grain products than you do the in quotes whole grain, the higher fiber, more conducive to health type products. So they are a double-edged sword. But the carnivore diet is really born from people's problems and intolerances. And so I have a degree of empathy for people who hop on the carnivore diet because they're just trying to figure out what's wrong with them, why are they manifesting these adverse symptoms, like gastrointestinally or autoimmune wise, as they suspect. And sometimes it just kind of comes down to an elimination diet, and what really could you use for a base of an elimination diet, aside from something high protein and something that is relatively inoffensive digestively. And you arrive at the carnivore diet, and then there's a lot of legend and lore surrounding the carnivore diet, and there's a lot of almost socio-political implications with being this tough, this meat eater, this guy who goes out and hunts the wild beasts and brings it home on his back. Like, yeah, I'm a carnivore dieter, but yet I'm afraid of a piece of broccoli. So there's humor in there, but I try to be empathetic to the reasons why people jump on that. And the main issue I have with carnivore diet advocates is the common claim among them that a purely animal diet is optimal for human health, when that is clearly not true, per the evidence and just per just some basic logic. And at the same time, there's people on the other end of the spectrum who are just deathly afraid of animal foods and vehemently preach against them as being unhealthy, and that's untrue too. So.
Yes, I do believe for most people the key lies in the moderation or the balance of several things. But I too have had a client, I will say, who had severe gastrointestinal issues, and she said she's tried so many things, low FODMAP and whatnot with a specialist as well, nothing would work. And I was like, oh, are you open to trying something? I don't know. She's like, yeah, what is it? And so we got her on the carnivore diet, and she said she had never felt that good. And mind you, we did exactly what you said. We started reintroducing things slowly again, progressively, in order to figure out what exactly it was that her gut would respond to. So I do think some people use the carnivore diet for the wrong thing, wrong in the wrong way, just completely thinking for the eternity, I'm not going to eat any kind of grains. Or then when they do go to a birthday party and have some bread, they feel guilty about it the next day. And they, I think in this sort of sense, it can create a really negative relationship with food.
Yeah, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. And we as a species are most of us anywhere are designed to eat essentially anything. I mean, people are surviving and thriving on all kinds of diets across the spectrum of diet types. And as long as protein and total calories are good, and you know, you're getting a reasonable variety of foods and most of your essential nutrition, you're going to live almost as long as anybody else, as long as you stay physically active and keep body composition in check. And so there's just an incredible variety of diet types that humans can survive and thrive on, because that's just how we're built. You know, we're highly resilient and flexible type of species.
Well, I think that's actually a wonderful message. People would always like to hear like that magic ingredient or that magic diet, but actually saying that, hey, you can diversify it according to your culture, your preferences, and so on. I think that's actually a much nicer takeaway. But yeah, I'm curious because you and your wife also, if anyone following you on Instagram, you both have a very fit physique. You look strong and healthy.
Thank you.
So I'm curious if you have tried the carnivore diet yourself, or what is your personal and your wife's approach in terms of nutrition?
Yeah. So I have been blessed with a very tolerant digestive makeup, and I don't have any intolerances or allergies. And if I did, I would have ran into it by now, and I haven't. So I've been very fortunate in that respect. So this has naturally made me gravitate towards eating anything that won't eat me first. And so I do like a variety of foods. I like a variety of foods across the food groups and within the food groups. And naturally, when you're able to consume foods from each of the food groups and a diversity of foods within the food groups, then you're naturally going to get a wider spectrum of essential nutrients and beneficial nutrients. And so I try to keep my variety up through the course of the day and the course of the week, but there are definite staples that I employ and that I love. And macronutrient wise, so yeah, definitely an omnivore. I love an abundance of plant foods in the diet. I also love various animal foods. I don't ban certain foods that carry a degree of risk. And like, for example, red meat and eggs, you know, they're always going to have this ball and chain around them in the literature that says, cardiovascular disease, watch out, watch out. But you know, the magnitude of risk with eggs and you know, fresh lean red meat, and it's like, I'll take that gamble within the mix of foods within my diet while I personally maintain a good body composition and good physical activity and good blood work. And so I'll take the nutrition from those foods and you know, get the win-win, or at least not the win-lose. So, yeah, I just don't discriminate with food types. I have my favorites. Macronutrition wise, I would say that my diet's like high protein, moderate carb, moderate fat, and just very sort of moderate in all respects.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think that's a wonderful message because it's not in any extreme. It doesn't force people into one camp or another. And especially when it comes to the variety, that's also nice to hear because it gives you the freedom to include different foods. And even in along the lines of the more specifics when it comes to like the red meat and the eggs and so on, I think the important message that I want to underline is that you maintain a good body composition. I think people get too hung up in the specifics of what food or what exact macros, et cetera, is healthy, as opposed to thinking of that energy toxicity if we're just of a higher body fat percentage. But yeah, so anybody who does want to improve their body composition or who is wanting to go on a diet, what would you say are some of the most common or crucial mistakes that people tend to make?
Yeah, especially if now are you speaking specifically of body fat loss for the goal of
Yes.
body
Yeah, I
fat
would
loss?
say so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So maybe the common goal starts at the top, where people have the wrong expectations for rate of progress. And so when somebody's out there expecting, 1 to 2 kilogram loss of body weight per week, then they're just starting off on the wrong foot. So if people can set their goals properly from the beginning to roughly 0.5% to a full percent of their total body weight lost per week, then they've taken the first step correctly. Because when you set yourself up with the wrong expectations, then you give up sooner when those expectations are not met. And so that's big mistake number one, is expecting quicker weight loss than you really should be expecting. And I am personally a fan of the 0.5% of your total body weight per week loss. I'm definitely a fan of that, 2% a month. That's fast enough. And especially if you take that and splay it out over the long term, over like a 6 month period or a 12 month period, that is a lot of weight loss. And so, especially if you keep it off, then the next mistake that people make is thinking that there is some sort of special diet or special food selection that they need to eat. People need to prioritize the consumption of the foods they personally like, because that is what they'll be able to stick to in the long term. So the concept of actually looking forward to your meals should be pursued. You should pursue a diet that you like and even love and look forward to, because that's actually more satiating than a diet that you feel you have to just kind of put up with the insipidness of. And so that's the other thing. People make the mistake of thinking, okay, there's a set of magic foods. Let me look them up. There's six magic foods that I need to just eat and kind of avoid everything else, because apparently everything else is going to kill me or stop my fat loss, or just, do any number of things that these wild claims, that the media, or the mass media, and particularly the diet media, claim. And so, and that brings me to the next mistake. When people think that there's a special set of foods, they naturally are getting this information from all over the place on the internet. So just kind of stop listening to what gurus are preaching. And whenever a guru preaches an always or never type of message, and this is very common with guys who are in supermarkets, in their social media, and they're saying, "Oh, look at this food. It's got this little ingredient here that's gonna kill you." Yeah. "Oh, look at this. Ooh, this is the wrong kind of food. Look at this little ingredient." Just, ditch all of that nonsense. I mean, these guys are just silly and uneducated charlatans who are just propagating, missing the forest for the trees. As long as your food selection is predominated by whole and minimally refined foods, don't worry about one fruit being more healthy than another. Don't worry about one type of potato being more healthy than the other. Don't worry about, in quotes, seed oils or these little, ingredients in the food supply that are really not going to be consumed in large quantities unless you're eating a bunch of deep fried foods at greasy spoon diners, And so be careful about media messages, and be careful about social media nutrition preachings from gurus who try to educate people on the basis of scaring people away from foods. That is a sure sign. If somebody is saying, "Oh, this is dangerous, this food is dangerous, and don't ever have a diet soda a day because it got aspartame, that's dangerous, it's going to kill you," then you know to run for the nearest exit when you hear somebody preaching like that. And okay, well, I know I went off on a little bit of a rant and a soapbox. So let's pull back. So number one, proper rate of weight loss expectation, 0.5% to a full percent reduction per week. And then number two, there's no magic foods. Just predominate your diet with mostly whole and minimally refined foods. And an exception there would be protein powder, which is highly refined, but it also happens to result in favorable health outcomes unanimously. And then, third thing I would say that people make big mistakes about is thinking that there's some sort of macronutrient breakdown that is going to be the ticket to weight loss. So usually what the claim in that direction is that you have to cut carbs out or down and go low carb or low carb ketogenic in order to lose weight. That is a very common misconception. So when you're reducing total caloric intake, then, well, yes, the carb macro is probably the most expendable because you're not going to be reducing protein. You're going to keep that optimal if you can. And there's a limit to reducing fat before you start running into issues in that direction. And so people who are trying to lose weight are probably best served by, modifying the carbohydrate aspect of their diet. But there's still always room for carbohydrate in the diet. So that brings me to the main point here is that you should go by personal preference with regard to how much carb and fat that you want in your diet, because there's no magic amount of carbs below which you will lose fat quicker or above which you'll have trouble losing fat. If you're somebody who likes to run a relatively low fat diet with moderate to higher carbs, but you're still netting a caloric deficit, then that is going to get you to your goals if you can sustain that. And if you're somebody who prefers to really lowball carbohydrate, even to the degree of running a ketogenic diet, then great. That's your personal preference. That's what you'll be able to stick to. Then that's what you should be doing. Because ultimately, when you get protein and calories right, the differences between rate of body fat loss between diets is negligible. Now, of course, if you have athletic performance goals and you're, emotionally attached to ketogenic diets, then you're going to run into some issues with your potential there. But for the goal of weight loss and fat loss, it really is a matter of getting protein right, getting total calories right, and making sure the diet overall is satiating and with its food selection. And then high carb versus low carb, it doesn't matter. Go with personal preference. Let's see. The other thing other mistake that the general public makes is they buy into too much hype surrounding particular eating patterns through the course of the day or the course of the week. And once again, we have a very colorful and diverse set of media messages that people have to deal with. And a lot of the times, the fasting and intermittent fasting variants, they get put up on a pedestal because there's a lot of good research on fasting, and fasting has performed quite well in the peer-reviewed literature in the weight loss department. And of course, along with weight loss, you have improvement in a range of cardiovascular health parameters. And so because intermittent fasting has done well in the research literature, then the natural thing for we humans to do is just put it up on a pedestal and place a health halo around intermittent fasting. And then the lay public has this tendency to latch on to these ideas and just go to extremes with them and think, okay, well, everybody needs to intermittent fast because this one doctor said so. Everybody needs to intermittent fast because this one guru said you need to do that to make sure your cells properly regenerate, and other such bold and wild and imaginative claims like, oh, this guru said that I need to wait an hour before my first meal, and then I need to stop eating 3 hours before bed so I can keep my eating window down to like 7 or 8 hours max. And then you think to yourself, well, okay, well, this is crazy and it's not evidence-based. And what we have to do is look at fasting and intermittent fasting variants as just tools in the toolbox. We just have to look at them as options for people who prefer them. So intermittent energy restriction models have performed similarly well to daily caloric restriction models for the goal of not just weight loss and fat loss, but also improving cardiometabolic parameters such as glycemic control, blood lipids, and other such risk factors. Hasn't shown superiority when you match the actual caloric deficit by the end of the week, but they've shown similar success. And the fasting models have the, I guess maybe the added benefit in a lot of people of being able to be run in an unrestricted and unmicromanaged fashion and still work similarly to this sort of micromanaged daily caloric deficit that that you have to try to hit. So what that tells us is, hey, we have more options now for programming for people who are seeking to lose weight but don't necessarily do that great with trying to run a daily caloric restriction model. We could just have them on either a modified fast or a full-blown fast a couple of days a week, and they'll reach the same deficit by the end of the week and not feel like they're dieting necessarily for 5 days a week. Ah, that's pretty cool. But we know the mechanism by which that works, and now we have another option. And then another option, of course, we can have people narrow their feeding windows without going crazy and saying, hey, it has to be an early time restricted feeding window. We can say, ah, you have a choice of when you want to narrow that feeding window and just adopt a pattern that works best with your personal preference and your schedule and all of that. So now we have more options, which is a good thing. So going back to how this relates to your question, it's like people tend to think that things like intermittent fasting are superior and something that everybody has to do. And that's just not true. So a lot of these mistakes that people run into dieting have to do with hearing information out there floating around the media and then sort of misinterpreting it and misapplying it and actually end up preaching it to others in the incorrect way. So those are just a few of the things that the general public is doing wrong with respect to the fat loss process. And I actually think of another one. It's sort of this downplaying of, or not downplaying, but a lack of awareness of the benefits of resistance training in the program for improvements in body composition. Because if you're running a caloric deficit, okay, that's one of the major cornerstones of what you need to do. But another major cornerstone you need to do is retain lean mass and maybe even gain some if you can while you're losing body fat. And so resistance training is going to be a crucial piece to achieving that. And a lot of dieters out there in the general public are just not aware of that. And so they don't have that element solidly in their programs. So
Yeah, so many great things. Just touching on that last point here right away. I believe in terms of resistance training, oftentimes people are too focused on the scale, and so if they think, oh, if I'm gaining muscle, or it might appear that the scale is moving too slowly if we're at the same time building muscle or so. So I think that that is one point. Of course, also just thinking that of that old myth of just cardio burns fat, and therefore we're just going to do cardio. Cardio and only focus on nutrition and not thinking of that retention of that lean body mass. Certainly something that I have seen among my clients also. But going back to the other things you were saying, what, if I hear you correctly, kind of the trail that I see through everything is that adherence is absolute key. And also just that overall picture of energy balance and energy toxicity, getting our body weight to or body fat percentage to a good range, that is really the thing that matters more than all these nitty-gritty little things. I personally, before I learned about flexible dieting 9 years ago or so, I also tried paleo, low carb, whatever, and I would always feel deprived. So to your point of the carbs, for example, I actually feared certain carbs, and I thought if I just eat this bread, it's gonna make me fat overnight, regardless of the quantity. And then learning about, hey, I can incorporate that, it was so liberating to me. And I actually felt so much more satiated and just at peace, not having to think about certain foods all the time or stress about them. So I 100% agree with your message there in terms of individualization. And same thing with the fasting. Of course, I tried that too because I thought, oh, you need to intermittently fast to help with cell autophagy or whatever else. And I was so like almost lightheaded in the morning. I really felt like it was impacting my stress response as well, and so on. And so that was just not a good experience for me personally. Like you said, for some people, it might be a really good way to just mitigate their calorie intake. But yeah, I really like that take home message of like, hey, you need to be able to adhere to it, and you can make that your own however you like. You also spoke about a certain time windows in terms of eating or frequencies and so on. And one thing that's kind of out there, and that one of the articles in your review, I believe it was written by Yassim Luck or something like that. I'm not entirely sure, but he was talking about the post-exercise anabolic window. Of course, that's kind of a, you know, it's still a topic. It's been a topic forever, but maybe you want to shed some light on that.
So Yassin Lakh and his colleagues, they actually used our model. We did a meta-analysis, Brad and myself and James Krieger. We did a meta-analysis on protein timing comparisons, and we found that there is no apparent, in quotes, anabolic window, because the studies we looked at specifically compared conditions where protein was consumed within an hour of either side of the training resistance training bout, versus conditions where there was a minimum of 2 hours of protein neglect, of nutrient neglect, actually, a minimum of 2 hours on both sides of the training bout. And we found no effect of the protein timed conditions as long as total daily protein was around 1.6 to 1.7 grams per kilogram of body weight. And this our meta-analysis contained 13 studies, so it was, you know, it was a pretty robust type of analysis. And 11 years later, Yassin Lakh and colleagues, they ran a randomized controlled trial where they compared immediate administration, immediate ingestion of protein on both sides of the training bout, versus a 3 hour protein neglect period on both sides of the training bout. And so if there is any kind of, in quotes, anabolic window to have your protein close to the training bout, then Yassin Lakh and his colleagues would have found it. And lo and behold, you know, they kept protein at about 2-ish grams per kilogram of body weight per day. These are in highly, they were in resistance trained subjects on a specific structured training program that was designed to maximize adaptations to resistance training. No advantage of the anabolic window conditions versus the anabolic window neglect conditions, as long as total daily protein was in place. And so what this tells us is that the body is a lot more clever than we give it credit for. And it also tells us that specific timing schemes, you know, pre-exercise and post-exercise and things like that, with respect to the goal of maximizing muscle gain, are negligible, trivial at best. And so, as long as you're looking at a group of subjects who's eating protein with, I would say, at least a frequency of like 3 times a day, then they're going to be protein fed for the majority of their waking hours anyway. And so, the time course of digestion and absorption of meals is anywhere from like 3 hours to a small for a small meal, 6 hours to a large meal. So you're not looking at instant appearance and disappearance of protein and you know, amino acid availability. You're not looking at these little snapshots in time that exist and don't exist. You're looking at these long drawn out appearance curves in the blood of nutrients. And so the idea that we need to worry about half an hour here or an hour there of timing protein relative to the training bout in order to maximize resistance training outcomes is just actually kind of silly. And not only that, but when people harp about the post-exercise anabolic window, they're completely ignoring the fact that, well, you're talking about conditions that don't involve a pre-exercise meal at all. You're talking about overnight fasted conditions where the timing of the post-exercise meal might matter in order for you to maximize recovery and sort of rescue the kind of catabolic nature of the training bout itself. But when you have a pre-exercise meal, that pre-exercise meal is going to take some time to digest and absorb, and peak levels of nutrient circulation in the blood as a result of that meal are going to happen at least an hour after you consume it. And so if you're still burping up your pre-exercise meal at the end of your workout, then certainly this so-called post-exercise anabolic window, it's of zero concern at all. But nevertheless, people ignore how the pre-exercise meal dictates the post-exercise physiological milieu. And then they start preaching about, oh, we got to have very specific things at very specific times post-exercise. And it just makes no sense. And the evidence doesn't support it. So the question then becomes, okay, so how do you optimize protein distribution through the day for the goal of maximizing muscle growth? Then that's a whole different conversation. And so I would speculate that, and I've written a paper about this with Brad Schoenfeld, where we discussed how do you maximize muscle protein synthesis per meal? And it comes down to enough protein to stimulate a maximal MPS response, and then have as many maximally anabolic protein feedings in a day that would equal a maximally anabolic total daily protein for the day. So since we're starting at the top here with total daily protein being the most important factor, and then distribution and timing being of secondary, distant secondary importance, then you get the cake right, and then you can look at the icing on the cake. So the cake is the total, the daily total, which per the weight of the evidence looks to be somewhere between 1.6, 2.2 grams per kilogram of body weight. And then the maximally anabolic dose per meal of protein is somewhere between 0.4 up to potentially 0.55 grams per kilogram of body weight. So if you have four of those maximally anabolic protein feedings in the course of the day, then you will hit 1.6 to 2.2 grams per kilogram of body weight per day. And you're kind of doing everything we know of today to, maximize the growth adaptations in muscle over time. And it really has not much to do with where and how close you place these doses to the training bout. Now, with that said, Lisa, I don't think the general population who wants to put on a little bit more muscle than average needs to worry about having four protein doses a day at minimum with 0.4 to 0.6-ish grams per kilogram of body weight, which translates to roughly 30 to 50 grams of protein. I don't think that the general public needs to worry about that. I think that if a bro out there in the world just wants to make some progress and is not necessarily pushing the envelope, and certainly people in the general population who just kind of want to be generally healthy and stave off as long as possible diseases of frailty, then I think that they'll do just fine consuming a minimum of three protein feedings a day. Don't worry too much about the doses. Just try to have it spread through the day if you can. If you can't, then just nail the total and keep your resistance training program in place and you'll be fine. I think there's a lot of nitpicking and a lot of ado about nothing when amongst the general public who isn't trying to pull out the theoretical stops to becoming like a national level bodybuilder and up. So
Yeah, thank you once again for simplifying this for us, and not just simplifying it in the sense of, oh, don't worry about the rest, but simply saying like, The rest, the evidence is really trivial at best when it comes to supporting any specific timings. But I do also like that you highlighted kind of having your training in a somewhat fed state, or you know, if you are training fasted, it might be different. So again, I train in the morning most of the time, and I do have some kind of food within an hour or two afterwards, also just to help my body relax. And like I feel like it just helps me like initiate that recovery process. So it's definitely also more of a mental thing for me. But yes, I love that you say it comes down to total daily protein more than anything, and that's what people should really mostly be focused on. So thank you for elaborating on that, and I want to make sure I respect your time, but I would love to hear what's coming up for you in the next few months in terms of seminars, or also just in terms of like what research excites you at the moment.
Yes. So seminars, I just got back from Singapore, which was really great. I did three back-to-back
Wow.
seminars in Singapore, and one of them was a small QA at my friend's gym, and then the other ones were actually sold out seminars, which was really cool. So I had a lot of fun with that. I've never been to Asia in 40 years, so it was great to
Amazing.
revisit, and great food. It's Singapore is super interesting because the food is kind of like a fusion of like Chinese-ish food and Indian food, and I love both of those, you know. And so when there's sort of this fusion going on, I'm like, dude, let's go, man. This is good. So that was fun, and I've got the Dominican Republic in front of me in November, which is going to be really cool. Put together by AVSS, and really good group of people. And let's see, research that I'm excited about. I was just asked to write the next ISSN position stand on diets and body composition. So that's going to be, they revise their, just like these major organizations, they tend to be on a 10-year schedule for revising their position stands and reissuing them. And so the last position stand of the ISSN on diets and body composition was in 2017. So I'm on track for we're on track for an update. It's
Amazing.
going to take a long time to do it, but I was asked to be the lead on it, so I accepted. And to me, it's worth it. It's not it's more a labor of love than I mean, you don't make a penny from it. You just do it to impact the field. So I'm happy about that. And I just got a systematic review passed into publication. Well, you battle the peer reviewers, and then you get the stuff past publication. So that's a triumphant thing with Ali Redha and colleagues, and that's going to happen. And I'm excited about the level two certification, nutritional coaching certification for the Nutritional Coaching Institute slash Clean Health, who they merged with. So I was in charge of putting together that course. So I'm excited about that. That's going to launch soon. So there's a lot going on over here, Lisa. Yeah, I'm
There
up to my ears in alligators, as the saying goes.
Well, very exciting, especially the one with the international the position stand for sure. I will be keeping my eyes and ears out for that one in 2027 or whenever it's coming out.
Yeah.
But super cool, and I just really want to thank you for your time and just everything that you do. I will, of course, put all your links in the show notes so people can go and check out your book, Flexible Dieting, your research review, and everything else that you do. So truly, thank you for your time.
Well, thanks for my back, Lisa. And you're killing it out there. You're walking the walk, and you're staying in amazing shape and leading a really well-balanced lifestyle. So it's really great to see that. You're one of the leaders out there making things great for the general public as well as the professional. So I appreciate you as well.
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Ellen Aragon. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go and give us both a follow on Instagram or YouTube. One more thing before you go, if you are looking for premium supplements, our partner Fat Muscle Project has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more. And feel free to use our code NCL at checkout. Thank you for listening, and don't forget, life is too short to be in a body you don't feel good in.